Okay, welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and I have a very important announcement before we get started today. It is my vice chair's birthday.
Woo!
So we are going to sing a very quick happy birthday.
No, we're not.
Led by the chair. Ready? One, two, three.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Ellen. Happy birthday to you.
This meeting is adjourned.
And many more.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I had to do it.
Madam Chair,
yes?
I'd like to give Senator Olson. Senator Olson came to my office last week sometime and took some of my pears out of my office. And I'd like to return some. They're a little on the rotten side right now. I'd like to give them rotten pears for you.
It must be noticed that when I took his pears, I put oranges in place of them.
Yeah. No intent to steal, just replace.
Right. That's right. That's right.
This is just so you know, we do happen to have fun in strange ways at the Oregon Legislature. And anyway, happy birthday.
Thank you.
It's an honor to have you as my vice chair. And with that, we're going fishing today.
Let's rumble.
But before we get started on this hearing, I just wanted to make it clear that we are going to attempt to hear everybody who's here today. However, and I can stay till 5:30 today. I think my vice chair can as well. We do have some members that are going to have to leave. Yeah. We're going to try to finish on time, and we do have a number of people that would like to testify. So if we start after the panels, we may end up using this is going to be our two-minute warning sign for testimony. So I'm just going to alert you to that. The other thing I'd like to just remind folks before we open the hearing that if you have written testimony, please hand it to Sue, our trustee assistant. She will pass it out. And I'm going to ask people, please do not read your testimony. It's a lot more effective if you can just give the key bullet points, and because we are capable of reading it, and but having a summary of those important points is the most effective way to deliver your testimony. With that, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 736, and Beth, if you could provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 736 prohibits gillnet fishing in the lower Columbia River except in off-channel fishery enhancement areas specified by rule of the Fish and Wildlife Commission effective January 1st, 2012, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Great, thank you. And we've asked the chief co-sponsors of the bill, legislators, to come up and start off the hearing. Then we're going to hear from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then we're going to have some alternating panels and then take alternating testimony. So with that, Senator Girod and Representative Kinnemer, come on up to the dais. I'm not sure you sang happy birthday, but I just make sure and say
this
it
to
you.
This is the third time he's had to sing it.
That's hard sled.
We have fun in our committee. And I know, like your tie, if for folks who can't see, is that a fish tie?
Yes, it is. I'll talk about that when I give my testimony.
Okay. Whoever would like to go first?
I'll go first. I have to be in the next door here in a few minutes. And I'll be relatively brief. My name is Senator Fred Girod. I represent District 9. But more importantly, I represent several watersheds, the Upper Clackamas, the Mullala, the North, and South Santa Yam. You're going to hear a lot about fishing this time. I have been my whole life a sports fisherman. I love to fish. But I want to bring up another point that you probably are not going to hear today, and that's the impact that fish have had on my district. And that is, it's going to be gigantuan. What has happened right now is because of the ESA fish, the winter steelhead and the salmon, below Big Cliff Dam, they're going to trap those fish, and they're going to move them above Detroit Dam to the natural spawning grounds, collect the fish on the way back down, and then flush them down the river. The problem with that is it could very well put the city of Salem, the drinking water that you have here, and the city of Staten and the irrigation district into constriction of their water rights. And so it could have just a huge detrimental effect. That's the small price that we might be starting to pay for fish. Look what happened down on the Klamath. And the huge price there will magnify that by about 10 or 20 times. And each one of you with the exception of maybe Senator Haas, has major tributaries or channels of water that are impacted by the lack of fish. Now, if you look at the low-hanging fruit, what's the low-hanging fruit that we have right now? And it has to be gill netters. And this is not a new issue. Everyone knows that this is an old issue. And the reason that it's low-hanging fruit is you have 48 gill netters in 2008 that caught fish. 48. You have 300,000 sports fishermen that have been decimated by the lack of fish as well. And you look at all the cottage industries that they have, the restaurants that you might have if you go fishing, the motels, the guides, the fishing rods, the bait shops, the boats, the motors. It is huge, and the financial impact is huge. Now, besides those two financial impacts, the direct parts that we have that we're impacted on, plus the sports fishermen, I don't know how many of you know what the mitigation cost is for hydro and the power bill that you have. It's one-third. So we have to do something about the fish problem that we have. And again, the low-hanging fruit is the gill netters. We have consistently asked that they just modify their technique. Just use seine nets. They don't want to do that. They are just resistant to change. This bill that's before you right now is a compromise bill to start with. This will allow them to fish and catch fish. And the thing is, what's going to free up is the wild fish then will be free to come up to the tributaries and spawn. So I think it is extremely important that you get behind this bill. And like I said, every one of you, Senator Thompson, you have the Sandy. They have problems. Floyd, you have the Willamette that have definite problems. And I got to tell you, the city of Staten had to put in sequential batch reactors because of water quality and fish, and that would cost you and Eugene and Portland probably 5 to 10 times your sewer rate that you're paying right now. So I mean, we're not talking small numbers. This could be a multi-billion-dollar problem. And like I said, in 2008, we're talking 48 gill netters. We're not talking a whole lot. And each one of those gill netters caught about $6,000 worth of fish. Now, that's old data. That's from 2008. But again, thank you very much for hearing this bill. Thank you, Chair. I think this is a big, big issue for my district. We're at the end. I'm the tributary. I'm where they spawn. We're the ones paying the price. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and birthday boy. Great to see you. I am Bill Kennemer, state representative from Oregon City, Canby area, and I would note Oregon City is perhaps the premier sports angling spot for salmon and steelhead on the lower Willamette. It's interesting being here today. It's sort of a moment of deja vu.
We have many of those moments in the legislature.
Well, and I'm getting to have more of them. In the previous century, I served 10 years in the Senate. And one of those years was in 1991 when we had a gill net bill. And that's what this tie is reminiscent of. It's a little fish tie.
It's like a sturgeon. I can't
looks
tell.
Like a bat. Well, there's been some controversy about what this is. We just called it an endangered species. But it's one of those fish, and one of those important fish, and one of those fish that I think the sports anglers need to get a hold of. It was back on March 8, 1991, that I sat in this very hearing room and with my fish tie on and talked about a gill net bill at that time. And if I could, I'd like to just read a couple of things from the transcript, and my comments are brief here. But anyhow, I introduced Senate Bill 611 with the -1 amendments. And then it goes on in the transcript of it says that Kennemer feels that it's vital to preserve the wild fish. This bill is proposed to prevent drop kill due to gill netting. The bill also addresses the use of modern technology to harvest fish. The result is more fish for both commercial and wild fish, and is designed to prevent the federal government from declaring the salmon and other fisheries as endangered species. Question from Senator Brenneman at the time. Do you have any research documenting the damage to the resource?
Senator Cantermer. In the response that follows, in the testimony that will follow me, there will be lots of specifics and lots of evidence. This is not an assault on the Gillnet industry. The issue is management of the resource. And I guess that would be my comment again today. I think it's time for us to take the next step. Sherry and I love fishing, but the many hours it takes to catch those salmon, we need to do some things to improve that, and this is a step in the right direction. I appreciate your time. I encourage your support, and there are many here who can testify about the issues involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate you coming over.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Senator Johnson, did you want to come up? Okay. Well, I didn't know if you had time to stay. ODF&W is going to come up and do a presentation, but if you'd like to come up and say a few words.
I'm trying to wait until after the presentation.
Okay. So we have Department of Fish and Wildlife. Committee members, I had asked Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up and provide an overview since we have several new members of the committee who have not seen this presentation or heard about the background directly from Department of Fish and Wildlife before. I wanted to make sure that we had a background presentation from the department before we hear from the proponents and opponents of the bill. I was going to say sorry to all of those of you who have to crane your neck. Okay. Kurt.
Good afternoon, Chair Dinkfelder.
You can sit up.
Yeah.
Members of the committee.
Did we lose it?
We'll see here. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And the Chair asked me to come today and just provide a brief overview of Columbia River Fisheries and Columbia River Fishery Management. I wanted to, before I embarked on that discussion, and I will go through the slides very quickly because I know you have a lot of folks here today and then I'd be happy to answer any questions. I wanted to also just let you all know that I come to you as the Deputy Director in my current capacity. However, I spent about 15 years of my career working on the Columbia River. I actually started my career on the Columbia as a seasonal fish checker. I worked my way up and was ultimately the Columbia River Fishery Manager for a number of years in the early 2000s before moving on into my current capacity. So I have a lot of experience with Columbia River fish runs and fisheries. So I wanted to give you just a brief overview here. The four things I want to highlight for you today, I want to talk a little bit about ESA listings and stock status. I want to talk to you a little bit about the fisheries that are in place on the Columbia River, talk to you a little bit about the management forums in which all the fishery management decisions are made with regard to Columbia River fisheries, and then lastly talk a little bit about constraints and how what the number of provisions are that essentially constrain our fisheries on the main stem Columbia. With regard to the Endangered Species Act, we now in the Columbia Basin have 13 ESA-listed stocks of salmon or steelhead. Additionally, we have two non-salmon and steelhead stocks that are listed. Green sturgeon were listed in 2006, and Ulacon or Columbia River smelt were listed just last year in 2010. Virtually every river system now in the Columbia Basin has at least one listed salmon or steelhead stock present. I want to talk a little bit about stock status. This is a very high-level overview. This particular figure shows the Columbia River Spring Chinook returns over the last three decades. You'll notice that at the time of listing in the mid-1990s, we're down at very low run sizes. And since that time, actually over the last decade, we've experienced some of the largest runs in record with regard to aggregate spring chinook returns. Additionally, I wanted to mention that beginning in the late 1990s, the agency embarked on a mass marking program where we fin clip each hatchery fish that comes out of our hatchery programs. I wanted to throw in a few slides that are photos. This is a photo downstream from Bonneville Dam at Tanner Creek, spring chinook fishing. You'll see a number of recreational boats. This would be, of course, in Senator Thompson's district, and also bank anglers taking part. Summer chinook run size. Back in the mid-1960s, all summer chinook fisheries were closed by the then Oregon Fish Commission and the Washington Department of Fisheries due to low run sizes. You'll see that over the decades, we've essentially floundered around at relatively small runs in the 15 to 20,000 range. And over the last decade, we've experienced some very robust and improved returns. We did, in fact, reopen the recreational fishery in 2002 and commercial fishery opportunity in 2004. Fall Chinook, again, this is a composite of multiple stocks, both hatchery and naturally produced stocks. You'll see that there's definitely a cyclical nature to these returns. Over the last decade, again, the story is actually fairly bright with regard to the aggregate return. We have had some exceptionally large returns in the Columbia Basin. Those are all post-listing, so all of our fisheries are constrained by ESA listing constraints. That's a 50-pound fall Chinook that was caught by a friend of mine down at Buoy 10. This would be most likely an upriver bright, a stock of fall Chinook that's actually 100% or very near 100% naturally produced. It's the premier fall Chinook on the Columbia River, and it's really the result of essentially 100% natural production and very robust return. Upper right fall Chinook contribute to fisheries from southeast Alaska all the way down the Washington coast and then into the Columbia River up to the headwater or to the spawning areas in the Hanford Reach in Washington. Coho returns over the same roughly 30 year time frame. Coho are extremely vulnerable to marine survival. Improvements in marine survival, you'll see very large spikes in abundance when we have good marine survival, and then likewise when we have poor marine survival, very depressed returns. Columbia River Coho, lower Columbia River Coho, were listed under the federal ESA in 2005. And then lastly, I want to show a figure on Columbia River white sturgeon. We've been actively managing white sturgeon since the late 1980s when fisheries increased dramatically and harvest rates were quite high. You'll see that over the last two decades, despite our management, we're still seeing some declines in white sturgeon abundance and taking additional management actions, reducing those fisheries. And I know I'm going very quickly here, so I apologize for that.
If we have questions.
Sure. The four fisheries when we think about quote-unquote fisheries in the Columbia Basin, we think about non-Indian commercial fisheries, non-Indian recreational fisheries, treaty Indian ceremonial and subsistence fisheries, as well as treaty Indian commercial fisheries. Amongst each of these fisheries, there are certainly sub-components. There are upriver interests versus lower river interests. There are tributary fishery interests versus main stem fishing interests. It really runs the gamut. So the commission, in making harvest management decisions in the Columbia Basin, really has to keep an eye on all those competing interests, if you will. I want to talk a little bit about the fishing area. So this figure shows the Columbia River, where it, at least where it is in the state of Oregon, where it's our boundary with Washington. The recreational fishing area essentially is the entire river from the mouth at Astoria all the way upstream to the Oregon-Washington border above McNary Dam. The commercial fishing area is the essentially lower 140 miles of river from the mouth at Astoria upstream to Beacon Rock, which is approximately 5 miles downstream from Bonneville Dam. And the Treaty Indian commercial fishing area is from Bonneville Dam upstream to McNary Dam. Then, of course, there are tributary fisheries in both states, tributary fisheries with regard to recreational opportunity, as well as tributary fisheries for individual tribes. So the tribal interests have tributary fisheries as well. All the commercial fishing in the Columbia River Basin is essentially confined to the main stem Columbia River and select areas, off-channel areas down in the Astoria area. And I'm going to highlight those here in a minute. So you see the four green stars. Those represent the current, what we refer to as select areas. They're off-channel commercial fishing areas down in the Astoria area. And I will show you a little bit more detailed map here. So our most successful and prominent off-channel area is at Young's Bay. You'll see that's the first area upstream there on the south side of the Columbia River. We have three net pen sites. We do acclimate fish there, several different species and stocks for providing a terminal fishery for the commercial area or commercial fishery in the Astoria area. Additionally, we have a select area at Tongue Point and in the south channel there, highlighted, first one upstream from Young's Bay, and then a small terminal area at Blind Slough, Napa Slough, that you see the third one highlighted upstream from Astoria on the Oregon side, with one small select area on the Washington side, which is the Deep River terminal fishery there on Washington, on the Washington side of the river. I want to talk a little bit about harvest sharing. So harvest levels in the Columbia River reflect both negotiated agreements with the Columbia River Treaty Tribes as well as policy guidance from the state Fish and Wildlife Commissions, both Oregon and Washington. We work with, of course, with Washington very closely to assure that we have concurrent regulations whenever possible. And bottom line is, though, that in the Maine Stem Columbia Endangered Species Act constraints have limited fishing opportunity essentially for all parties, be they treaty Indian, non-Indian commercial, or non-Indian recreational fisheries. And lastly, and I think you know this all too well, but a high demand for limited resource frequently leads to intense debate and conflict. We're, as an agency, as well as a fish resource, we're extremely blessed by a very engaged and passionate constituent groups, I should say, be they treaty Indian, non-Indian commercial, non-Indian recreational, as you see here in the room. We're really blessed by their interest in the resource. Again, just a real high-level overview over the last decade of harvest sharing in the Columbia Basin with regard to spring Chinook, summer Chinook, fall Chinook, coho, and white sturgeon. Spring Chinook, largely because of all the tributary fisheries that occur for spring Chinook. Clearly, the basin-wide spring Chinook catch favors the recreational fishery. Summer Chinook, much less so. Fall Chinook, pretty evenly matched between recreational and commercial interests. And then, alternatively, coho, another species of salmon that returns in the fall. Harvest sharing over the last decade clearly favors the commercial fishery. Lastly, white sturgeon, and essentially the Washington-Oregon Commissions have made a policy decision to share white sturgeon in the Maine Stem Columbia amongst the non-Indian fisheries at 20% commercial, 80% recreational. This second figure really is just the same data put into proportions as opposed into the total harvest. Talk quickly about fishery management forums. So, of course, I mentioned the Fish and Wildlife Commissions. Clearly, that's a key management forum for us. But then external to the commission process, we have U.S. v. Oregon, United States versus Oregon, Pacific Fishery Management Council, and the Columbia River Compact. And I'm going to go into a little bit more details on each of those. U.S. v. Oregon refers to the U.S. District Court ruling in 1969 that the treaty Indian tribes were entitled to, in the court's terms, a fair and equitable share of the harvest. That's largely been interpreted to mean 50%, so we have essentially 50% sharing, equal sharing with the treaty Indian fisheries in the Maine Stem Columbia River. After that initial court case in 1969, we spent, and I say we, I certainly was not involved, but we as a state, the state of Washington, spent a significant amount of time over the next two decades in court over issues with regard to Columbia River fishery management. The first management agreement was adopted and as a court order in 1988, which really laid out the framework for how fisheries, be they treaty Indian or non-Indian, commercial or recreational fisheries, how they were going to be managed to meet the terms of the U.S. District Court ruling. That agreement expired in 1998. We spent the next decade working on a new long-term agreement, and we managed fisheries on a series of interim 2 or 3 year short-term agreements. We did finalize a new agreement, and the court adopted that as a court order in 2008. That new agreement extends through 2017. Really, the focus of the agreement is on rebuilding weak salmon and steelhead returns, weak runs, as well as providing guidance for fish production as well as harvest decisions. So it really provides the framework for the commissions and the Columbia River Compact to make decisions that meet with the sharing agreements with the tribes. Parties to U.S. v. Oregon, Washington, Idaho, five tribes, Warm Springs, Umatilla, Nez Perce, Yakima, and the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, and then three federal agencies, National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The Pacific Fishery Management Council, which I mentioned earlier, is one of eight regional fishery management councils around the country that manages fisheries off the coasts of Oregon, Washington, and California. It's a critical piece of are our bigger picture fishery management, because our stocks, of course, leave the river and contribute to fisheries, be they in Washington, Oregon, or California. So we have to have basically a linkage between harvest management in the ocean as well as in the river. And we do that through something we refer to as the North of Cape Falcon process, where during the PFMC annual season setting process, we meet with the tribes and constituent groups to plan out fisheries and estimate impacts on Columbia River stocks in those ocean fisheries, because we have to account for those in our harvest sharing with the tribes. The Columbia River Compact refers to a compact that was created in 1915 by the states of Oregon and Washington to regulate fisheries on the Columbia River. In to comply with terms of the U.S., the federal constitution, anytime states get together and want to regulate commerce, if you will, it requires an act of Congress. States aren't allowed to regulate commerce independently, or I shouldn't say that, are not allowed to work together to regulate commerce without a compact in place. The Columbia River Compact, which gave the states the ability to work together in managing and setting regulations on the Columbia River, was ratified by Congress in 1918. The compact is, and there was additionally statutes adopted by the legislature to implement that compact. The compact is comprised of the Oregon and Washington Fish and Wildlife Commissions, and then the commissions have delegated their authority to the directors of the respective agencies to negotiate agreements and adopt rules. I want to talk briefly about non-Indian harvest management constraints. So, as a result of all these different management forums, all the requirements that are in place, we have, for non-Indian fisheries, a range of constraints that apply to various species. So in the case of spring chinook, our basic management constraints under USV Oregon are that 0.5, or one-half of 1%, to 2.7% of returning upriver spring chinook can be impacted in non-Indian fisheries. And when I say impacted, that means they are a mortality as a result of fishing. It's a sliding scale. When the runs are small, the allowable impact rate is small. As the runs get larger, the impact rate slides up to a maximum of 2.7%. We've typically been in the 1.5 to 2% range in recent years. Summer chinook, the current agreement allows for a 2% to 29.3% impact on returning fish, depending on run size. Summer chinook, interestingly enough, are not listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. We do, in both the spring chinook and the summer chinook components, we essentially have a catch balancing provision where the non-Indian harvest, that is the actual fish that are landed plus any catch and release mortalities, cannot exceed the treaty Indian commercial and subsistence harvest in combination. So we have a provision in the agreement with the tribes that says we will balance our catches so that, in keeping with equitable and 50% sharing, that we will not exceed their harvest and vice versa. Prior to that, the catch balancing provision came in the 2008 agreement. Prior to that, in most years, the non-Indian harvest did exceed the treaty Indian harvest in the early 2000s. Fall chinook, again, sliding scale. We're allowed 1.5 to 15% of the returning fish, depending on run size. We've typically been in recent years in the 8% range on fall chinook. And then on steelhead and sockeye salmon, a flat harvest rate, allowable impact rate, I should say, of 2% of the returning wild fish for steelhead, 1% for sockeye. As a result of all these constraints, all the management that's in place now, we've embarked on a number of harvest reforms. Just generally speaking, as a result of these constraints, harvest rates are now reduced over where they were historically. We use a combination of time, area, and gear restrictions to further reduce stock-specific impacts. And then we use run-size buffers. And what I refer to by that is most of the non-Indian fisheries that occur prior to us knowing absolutely what the run size is. We have a forecasted run size with a great degree of forecast error. The fisheries occur prior to the run size being updated with passage counts at Bonneville Dam. So as a matter of commission policy, the commission has directed us to essentially set aside 30 to 40% of that run size to hold it essentially for conservation to assure that if the run size declines, we won't exceed our take limits. Furthermore, and specifically with regard to commercial fisheries, we've now implemented mark selective fishery regulations for spring Chinook. We're now using a number of approaches, including the use of tangle nets, recovery boxes, shortened nets as well as shortened drift times, steelhead excluder panels. All commercial fishermen in the Columbia River participating in that fishery have to go through a mandatory training with our staff. And then lastly, we have an onboard monitoring program where we actually have employees on the water conducting onboard monitoring to estimate the impact on non-retained stocks and species. And lastly, we also use large mesh. So large mesh net, 9-inch mesh net, does not catch small fish. In general, most steelhead go through and do not get handled. Then specifically with regard to recreational fisheries, we have instituted mark selective regulations for spring Chinook, coho, and steelhead. And as a result of that, frankly, been able to leverage much, much more fishing opportunity with very small impacts on listed natural stocks. This figure is just a copy of one of our public information brochures. It highlights what I refer to when we talk about mark selective regulations and fin clipping. You see the adipose fin, which is a fleshy appendage there between the tail and the dorsal fin. At our hatcheries, in most cases now, those fins are clipped off when the fish are small. And when they return as adults, they either have a fin if they're naturally produced, or they don't have a fin. You see highlighted there, many of our fisheries are now directed on strictly hatchery fish, particularly in the Columbia Basin. You guys probably hear about Columbia River, commercial fishing gillnet boats. This is a pretty typical gillnet boat. This is actually during the tangle net season. You'll see spring Chinook there coming up. Note the observer on board, actually, in this case. This is a fish that's actually being landed then in a tangle net. You see this fish is actually hooked by the fins. So tangle nets are very small mesh, too small, in fact, for a fish to get its head in, too small to be gilled, too small a mesh, that is, to be gilled. This is a close-up of a fish that was landed in a tangle net. You see, actually, in this case, the fish was hooked right around the nose there, very, very much alive and in good condition. We require all the commercial vessels to have recovery boxes. This is what you see here is a two-chamber recovery box. The box, it has a high-velocity pump that pumps and recirculates water, fresh water from the river into the recovery box. Fish are placed in the recovery box after landing. Fish that are going to be released, that is, non-fin clip fish, placed in the recovery box until they're recovered and then released. Gives them clearly a good jump on dealing with things like pinniped predation and just generally a better start on things, if you will. And lastly, Chair Dingfelder, that was my hyperspeed discussion. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the department?
Yes, I've got a couple.
Okay, so I'll tell you what. Why don't you ask a couple, and we're going to go to Senator Thompson.
That's fine.
Okay.
Do it. Thank you, Mr. Melcher, for your wonderful report. What is the mortality rate of commercial fishery compared to sport fishery, and when was the last study done on that?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson. So on the commercial fishery, I assume you're referring to the spring Chinook, the tangle net fishery.
Yes.
We did a study in the early 2000s. It was a three-year study funded by Bonneville Power Administration where we went out with tangle net gear, actually with contracted fishermen, captured fish, used what are referred to as pit tags, which are a small electronic tag that is detected when it swims through a fish ladder. All the fish ladders have pit tag detectors now. Pit tagged those fish, also established a control group of fish that were never harvested or handled in gear. They were captured at the dam and then re-released to essentially set up a true control. Those data all from those studies all went through the USV Oregon process. We have a technical advisory committee that has to essentially rubber stamp and say that the data that the compact is using to make decisions is is the best and most reliable information. So those studies all went through the U.S. Fire and Technical Advisory Committee review process, and the impact rate that we're using on the commercial fishery is now, I believe it's 14.5%. So with regard to the recreational fishery, the last study that was done in Oregon, specifically in Oregon, was done at Willamette Falls in the 1990s. It was done a very comprehensive catch-and-release mortality rate study, peer-reviewed, exceptional piece of work. The mortality rate that resulted from that study was highly variable depending on the hook wound location. So really the critical factor on recreational mortality rates is where is the fish hooked. If it's hooked in the gut or in the gills, very high mortality rate. If it's hooked in the maxillary, the roof of the mouth, very low mortality rate. From that study, we developed essentially hook wound-specific mortality rates, and then we apply those to the recreational fishery as we know it in terms of the gear profile. And the result of that is essentially, at the top of my head, I think it's 9.6%. But it's right in the 10% range, which is the rate that we're currently using for recreational fisheries in the Columbia River system, 10%.
Do you have another question?
I do.
Thompson.
I do. Are you familiar with the review of economic literature and recommendations for improving economic data and analysis for managing Columbia River Spring Chinook? Have you ever heard of that study?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I believe, is that one that was done by OSU?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
What's the date on it?
2005. Oregon State, yes. Institute for Natural Resources for Oregon State.
Yeah. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, I am familiar with that study. I don't know that I can cite all the findings off the top of my head.
This is just one question I want to ask you, and then I'll pass. And I want to know if you believe this to be true. It says, finally, we remarked on the role of economics in the allocation question. The complexity and variability of the economic issues facing Columbia River fisheries make it impossible to find a stable, economically right allocation. Do you agree with that?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, not being an economist and being a lay person with regard to economics, I would certainly rely on their judgment. I believe we actually had a number of economists work on that. We basically commissioned them to do the report. So it is a piece of commission work. I would have no basis to say it's inaccurate.
I was just trying to put you on the spot is what I was trying to do.
I think you did that.
I think you did that. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Kurt, thanks. Were the safe areas that we're talking about today, were they designed to supplement the commercial fisheries, the gillnet? Can you give me some kind of new on this and can you give me the history on that?
So, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, these select areas, they actually really began perhaps as early as the late 1970s, early 1980s in Young's Bay, and they were really designed to enhance the existing commercial fishing opportunity at that time. They were expanded greatly in the 1990s. We had a Bonneville Power Administration funded project to basically evaluate alternative sites. The original site was just Young's Bay. Those other ones were not in place prior to the 1990s. We had a Bonneville Power Administration funded project to evaluate alternative sites, which we did. I want to say we evaluated a couple dozen different sites up and down the Columbia River. The ones that we have now in place are the ones that proved to be the most effective and promising for a variety of reasons. So then they came online in the 1990s as mitigation for lost commercial opportunity in the main stem.
Okay. Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Would the impacts to the, let's say, the mortality rates that you have to consider be zero if all the gill netting was done in these safe areas, or would there still be impacts to that percentage that we're looking at?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, these areas, although they're off-channel areas, they still have some non-local stocks. So salmon migrate. They're shoreline oriented. Certainly, some stocks or some salmon are always going to swim through these areas that are non-local stocks. They're also influenced by wind and tides. They can be carried into one of these areas on a tide. We do see non-local stocks in these fisheries, and we actually estimated and managed the fisheries currently to keep those impacts very low. So right now we have very active management of those fisheries with very limited openings in those areas to minimize the non-local stock interception. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me, I kind of sound like Senator Olson, right?
He's rubbing off on you.
Questions.
I'm going to be worried about that.
Would there be any impacts to federal dollars for our state hatcheries if there's no gill netting? Is there any federal dollars tied into this?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, most of our hatcheries in the Columbia Basin are federally funded, and many of them are not ours. They're Idaho or state of Washington's. Most and much of the funding comes through Mitchell Act, which you may have heard of. The Mitchell Act was essentially put in place in the late 1930s or 1940s to mitigate for the impact of the federal hydropower system and to mitigate for the lost commercial fishing opportunity. How those funds are jeopardized or not, whether there's fisheries, to be honest with you, I don't know. I mean, we get the Mitchell Act appropriation. We certainly have, and the Mitchell Act has a definite link to the treaty fisheries as well.
Mm-hmm. Is that anything you could look into and get back with us, or is there any way you can find that?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, I'm happy to dig up copies of the Mitchell Act and any language associated with that if you'd like.
One more follow-up?
One more. And then I allowed the Senator Olson to have one more since it's his birthday.
You're so nice.
Don't encourage him. We have a birthday tomorrow, too.
Gets one. That's it.
If we pass this bill and the gillnets have to go in these safe areas, how does this apply to the Washington side? And what control over that do we have?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, clearly I think if Washington were to try and assert their authority on our side of the river, I think you all and our constituents would not take too kindly to that. So I think clearly if this bill applies to Oregon waters, the Oregon state line is defined. It is an imaginary line, but it is a real line on the Columbia River, and I think this applies clearly to the Oregon side of the river.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Olson gets his birthday question.
This is my birthday question. If we were to relegate the commercial fishing to the safe areas or totally eliminated them by the passage of this bill, would this be able to extend the fishery for the sports fishermen? And what length of time could it extend it for?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, as I mentioned in my overview, certainly there are other factors that come into play. We have a catch balancing provision with the tribes. We negotiated our agreement with the tribes based on an understanding of some fisheries. I was the state's policy committee representative at USV Oregon when we negotiated the current agreement. Actually, we negotiated several interim agreements in the early 2000s, and it was truly a historic moment, if you will, in that we, the states, all and the tribes all agreed on how we were going to share impacts, and we agreed on that because of an expectation that there was a need to provide meaningful fisheries, be they sport or commercial. So certainly, if you have no commercial fishing impacts in the main stem Columbia, it's going to lead to some additional recreational fishing opportunity, no doubt about it. I can't sit here and tell you what that magnitude is. It would take some pretty serious analysis, and it also depends a lot on the assumptions that you put into that in terms of what other there's so many other factors. I mean, what's Washington going to do? If Washington continues to have a commercial fishery, then in theory there may be no benefit. What do the select areas look like? Do they only look like what we have right now, managed to the same constraints right now, or do we expand them? If we expand them, then those take some additional impacts. You can't, you know, so it's not just an even one-to-one transfer. So there's so many questions to be able to answer exactly what that magnitude is.
Tough issue, isn't it?
It is, and I'm sorry that you had to do this on your birthday.
Okay.
Actually, I can think of nothing better that he'd like to talk about than fishing on his birthday, but knowing that he's a bass fisherman. Thank you very much, Kurt.
Thanks.
Appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll have some follow-up questions for you. Senator Johnson, did you want to come up? If you wanted to stay here all afternoon, you're welcome to as well. But you have to sing happy birthday. No, I'm just kidding. I know.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. You heard one of the proponents of the bill say that fish are a big deal in his district as he supports the bill. I'm here to tell you fish are a big deal in my district, and I oppose the bill. My district, if you can picture it, runs from the mouth of the Columbia River all the way to the confluence with the Willamette. So this is a hot-button issue where I live. Colleagues, in this economic climate, the Oregon legislature should not be picking economic winners and losers. We should not be voting to put people out of business. The details of this bill will be left to others. I'm simply here to plead for the jobs of some of my constituents. Governor Kitzhaber has said that 15 jobs in Coos Bay equal 500 in Portland. And I am in complete agreement with him on that. I submit to you that if you pass this bill, you will have extinguished a significant number of jobs and the commensurate economic activity those jobs generate in my district, all this without any conservation benefit. If this bill passes, nothing will keep Washingtonians or tribal fishers out of the lower river. The people who you will unemploy if this bill passes weren't consulted about the impacts of the proposed legislation, yet they have already incurred significant costs to keep a sustainable fishery in place. And there may be other agendas afoot here, including a genuine interest to shut down all commercial salmon fishing in Oregon, regardless of the method. Instead of deciding who will still have a job at the end of this legislative session, we should put aside the old turf debate between recreational and commercial fisheries. We should begin to reason together to create more real opportunities for all fishermen, not just manufactured reallocation proposals that leave some hardworking Oregonians behind. I would ask the committee not to move these bills. Rather, create a work group with a significant charge to find solutions. Work with the agency. Work with each other. Dial down the mythology, the vilification, and the hyperbolic rhetoric in favor of collaborative outcomes that do more than just focus on who catches the last spring Chinook. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the Senator? Okay. Thank you very much. All righty. We have a number of people who would like to speak. We have some panels, and then we're going to take general testimony. First panel up is we have some tribal members that would like to share their input, Bruce Jim, Olney Pat Jr., and Michael Mason. And I've asked panels they can keep their comments to 10 minutes total, and then we'll take questions at the end. Michael, do you want to start off?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, and members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. My name is Michael Mason. I'm the state lobbyist for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon, and I'm basically here just to introduce folks. We have a stellar group. Of course, before you, Warm Springs Tribal Council member Olney Pat Jr. and Chairman of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, Bruce Jim. But also we have in the room Chief Wilbur Slokish, Tribal Council Member Austin Green, Chief Operating Officer Urbana Ross from the tribes, Tribal Attorney Howie Arnett, who is much more able to answer legal questions if those may arise than I, and Donnie Winneshut of the Warm Springs Fish and Wildlife Commission, as well as two grandsons of Mr. Jim, who are up-and-coming tribal fishermen. So a stellar group, and I want to turn it over to Chairman Jim, who has been with CRTFIC. He's been a commissioner with CRTFIC for 12 years, and Councilman Pat, who you have seen before, and testified on a similar bill in 2009 on the House side, has been both chair of the Warm Springs Tribal Council and executive director of Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. So these gentlemen are very, very experienced in these issues, and I think we'll shed some light on the issues that arise from the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Jim, who'd like to go first?
Well, first, good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Olney Pat Jr., and I'm a member of the Tribal Council of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I'm here today to offer comments and perspectives of the Warm Springs Tribe on SB 736, which would prohibit commercial gillnet fishing in much of the Columbia River below Bonneville Dam. As you know, Warm Springs is a treaty fishing tribe with a history dating back to time immemorial of fishing on the Columbia River for ceremonial subsistence and commercial purposes. You may also know that prior to my election to the Warm Springs Tribal Council, I served 5 years as executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. I'm also currently the chairman of the U.S. section of the Pacific Salmon Commission. Because of my background, I'm very familiar with the operation of both the treaty Indian and non-treaty or non-Indian fisheries of the Columbia River and the social, legal, and management issues involving those fisheries. Warm Springs appreciates that SB 736 is not directed at the treaty Indian fishery, which would be legally prohibited interference with the tribe's federally secured treaty rights. And we assume that the bill's authors, acting in good faith, do not expect the legislation to have an indirect impact on the treaty fishery. Nevertheless, we have some concerns. The bill's purpose is to shift the commercial gillnet harvest of salmon in the lower Columbia River to the sports fishery. Many of the fish taken in both the lower river gillnet and sports fishery are salmon bound for the treaty Indian fishing areas above Bonneville Dam and are therefore subject to the treaty Indian non-treaty harvest sharing arrangements set out in the federally court-approved USB Oregon Fisheries Management Plan. The current fishery management plan's term runs through 2017. Fisheries management, especially while the fishery seasons are underway, is a highly technical but imprecise science. Biologists and fisheries managers all recognize that sports fisheries are harder to monitor in season and therefore more difficult to manage than gillnet fisheries. Sports fisheries require much more manpower to monitor in season, and in this very challenging budget climate, we question whether ODFW has the resources to do the job right. Accurate and timely monitoring of the lower river sports fisheries has, in fact, been a point of concern of the tribes for some time now. From the perspective of a treaty tribe like Warm Springs, inadequate in-season monitoring of the lower river sports fisheries could have serious consequences for the tribal fisheries above Bonneville Dam. Inadequate monitoring could result in the lower river non-treaty fisheries exceeding their harvest share under the USB Oregon Management Plan, which could result in a reduction in the treaty Indian harvest and other problems, including legal problems within the USB Oregon management structure. Another concern is the possible negative impact of this legislation on the treaty Indian fisheries access to commercial markets. During the commercial fishing seasons above Bonneville Dam, the tribal fishers rely on commercial fish buying and fish processing businesses that are mostly based in the lower river communities. With the elimination of the commercial gillnet fishery from the main stem in the lower river, as SB 736 would require, we question whether the commercial outlets that the tribal fishers rely on can remain viable. Finally, as more of an observation than a concern, we've used SB 736 as an allocation rather than a conservation measure, contrary to what some of the bill's proponents claim. The overall non-treaty harvest of both wild and hatchery fish is tightly regulated by the USB Oregon Management Plan. This overall harvest will not change, regardless of whether the harvest is allocated solely to sports fisheries or shared with commercial gillnet fisheries. Thus, in fairness to the citizens of the state and to the non-treaty commercial fishermen of the Lower Columbia River whose livelihoods will be affected by this legislation, it should be publicly acknowledged that this is not a conservation measure, but simply a reallocation of the non-treaty harvest from commercial to sports fishing. Thank you for permitting the Warm Springs Tribe to present its views on SB 736.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Jim. I'm the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission chair and also a tribal fisher, but also a tribal head chair of the Fish Committee in Warm Springs. You know, we over time, I was looking at this speech here and then looking at Councilman Pat's, and we kind of share the same views here as written in here. But, you know, there's a lot of things that's missing in here when we start talking about the fisheries and stuff like that. I always try to kind of put it in the stepchild and syndrome, I guess, you know, that well, you have one child with a lollipop here and the other child standing on the side and the stepchild standing way back is what I put ourselves in. And many times we're always something's done at the whim of legislators without really looking at the ramifications of what it can cause or how much problems it can cause. And that's something I don't think that you guys have really looked into when you guys start looking at these bills on how much, what the domino effect is going to be as time goes on. What else you guys are going to have to do? What else you guys are going to have to add on next year, next year, next year, and following year? You know, I listened to the introduction on the bill in here, and I don't know how much more wrong that person that said that the how the sports groups build the economy, you know, by the buying their hooks and buying their boats and everything else like that. You know, in defense of commercial fishermen, as I am speaking of, you know, the commercial line not only employs themselves, but you know they have the product of what they have, the warehouses, the fish buying stations, the people employed by those buying stations, the restaurants, the grocery stores, the people that haul this stuff, airplanes, and you know it's millions to billions of dollars that livelihood creates. It's not something just for recreation or to have a good time. And that's what you guys have to realize. There's a limit to recreation and a limit to livelihood. And this strikes the livelihood of every person, not only Indian and non-Indian. We use these lower river fishermen as indicators in test fisheries. We have used them for a long time. That's for us to determine how much numbers of fish that are coming up, what stock is involved. When we start talking about limiting this, and there's no wording in here that protects the treaty fishing, then we're concerned. Because that interpretation that's going to be made in this bill here does not designate anything that cuts the Warm Springs Tribe, Yakima, Umatilla, and Nez Perce Tribe out of the Columbia River. If we go with this, you're going to cut the buyers off. You're going to cut the restaurants. Kurt's going to have his patrolmen out there making sure you don't buy Indian fish because they're commercially caught. See, that's what it's creating. It's creating a storm, a perfect storm, to where I don't think anybody would want to be in on it. And it's really dangerous thinking when you really start thinking of that. The other part,
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you if you can wrap up because we have many more panels. So
all right. Okay. Well, the other part here, just you'll get this here showing that what the tribes have contributed.
That would be great.
So
do you can you pass it out to the?
Yeah, it'll be passed out here. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the tribal panel?
Chair Dingfeld. Thank you. Again, I'm new at this, so this is probably information that you know very well. But if we didn't do, if Oregon and Washington didn't do Lower Columbia gill netting commercial, would that open it up for the tribes to go, move to the lower part of the Columbia?
Currently, the tribal fishing area for commercial fishery is Zone 6 between Bonneville Dam and McNary Dam. I don't believe that the tribes have ever precluded doing that, but the way the agreements are written is that we do our commercial fishing between those two dams. I don't think if you're asking if that's an automatic result, no.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, next up is Jim Martin and Dan Grogan. And again, folks, I'm going to just be a stickler about asking people to keep to their time limits.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and committee members. We were told originally we'd have 15 minutes for this panel. We will trim it down to stick to 10. My name is Jim Martin. I'm the retired chief of fisheries for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Spent 30 years managing fisheries for them, and now I work for a very large fishing tackle company as conservation director living in Molino. As background to this discussion, we need to think about 100 years of history in natural resource management, both Oregon and in this country. 100 years ago, we were market hunting most of our deer and our elk and our ducks and our game birds and commercial fishing essentially all of our fish. And now the entire policy has changed in this country and in the state. We made the decision in the 1930s to stop market hunting those species and those game species and to manage them for recreational uses. We stopped in 1958 gill netting in the coastal streams and restricted gill netting to the Columbia River. In 1974, we decided to eliminate gill netting of steelhead and manage them as a sport fish. And all of these changes over a long period of time have been driven essentially by two large policy issues. One is maximizing the economic value of these species for the people, and two is improving conservation. And what we have here with Senate Bill 736 is another opportunity to shift policy, another opportunity to move along that continuum for those same two reasons: to maximize economic value for our economy, for most of the people, and to improve conservation. During my career as a fisheries manager for ODFW, I watched the ESA listings come along and different kinds of tribal allocation agreements essentially constrain non-Indian fisheries and constrain non-Indian fisheries. And Kurt Melcher did a really nice job, I think, of pointing out that all the non-Indian fisheries now for spring Chinook have to operate within roughly a 2% impact on upriver stocks. So when incidental mortality of those fish reaches 2%, everybody's done, even including safe area fisheries that have a very, very small impact on upriver stocks, but still some. So the heart of the question before us here is how you allocate that 2% incidental impact. Right now, we allocate, the states of Washington and Oregon, allocate about 40% of that 2% incidental impact to the commercial mainstem gillnet fishery and safe area fisheries, and about 60% of it to mainstem fisheries. Now, Kurt showed you all the numbers about all the basin-wide catches. The vast majority of those basin-wide recreational catches occur in tributaries. They don't occur in the mainstem Columbia River. This policy is about the mainstem Columbia River. This policy essentially asks you given the strengthening and building of the safe area fisheries, is it the time to move the main stem commercial fisheries impacts largely into recreational fisheries expansion and move the commercial fisheries into the safe areas, given the number of fish that they're catching, giving their continued access to supply to the resource, giving those opportunities for those jobs on a long-term basis, and put this controversy a bit to bed. Now, there's two fundamental issues at hand here with regard to the allocation of those ESA impacts. One is how efficiently each fishery translates those into available hatchery fish for either the commercial market or in terms of angler days and economic value for the general economy. That's one part of it. In other words, the mortality rates use up wild fish while trying to get hatchery fish. The fishery that uses up the least wild fish and accesses the most hatchery fish creates the most economic value. And if it doesn't burn steelhead or baby sturgeon or other bycatch species and waste them, that's a plus too. That's a conservation plus. And that is the heart of what this is getting at. So I'd like to just spend a little bit of time talking about those mortality rates. Am I out of time?
You've got about a minute.
Okay. Spend a little bit of time talking about the economic value. The mortality rates that Kurt talked about at 15% are for tangle nets. Those are the nets that catch steelhead. The large mesh nets that let the steelhead through that he didn't mention, have a 40% mortality on wild fish. So management is trying to balance tangle nets when you cannot catch steelhead, large mesh nets when you have to protect steelhead but you burn too many wild Chinook. The fundamental problem is they don't catch enough hatchery fish per wild fish killed. The safe areas do. The safe areas currently produce two-thirds of the entire commercial fishery. This controversial mainstem fishery is one-third. The safe areas right now produce as many commercial fish as all of the fisheries, commercial and mainstem, over the last decade. In other words, safe areas are growing because the agencies are putting more and more fish in those areas. The second part of it is the economics. That hatchery fish put through the commercial market produces about $44 on average, according to ODFW. That hatchery fish put through the recreational market produces 8 angler days worth of expenditures. Each angler day of expenditures, based on independent economic analysis, is somewhere between $50 and $100, roughly. So you can do the math. You can figure out that even though we allocate 40% of our impacts to the mainstem commercial fishery, we don't get 40% of our economic value. We get far, far less of that, because each fish is less worth less, and the impacts burn those fish more. So I just want to just wrap up by simply saying this is largely about better economics out of an extremely limited resource. When you've got safe fisheries right now that burn almost no upriver impacts and produce as many fish just in those safe areas as is caught in the entire mainstem recreational fishery, and as many fish as both fisheries produced over the last decade on an annual basis. So these safe areas are places where we will continue to have access to the market, we'll continue to have good, stable commercial fishing jobs, and we can substantially expand the overall economic impact of this fishery by simply restructuring. Thank you.
Hey, Dan, he ate up a minute of yours, so.
That's okay. Mine's really short. Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I am Dan Grogan. I'm the owner and president of Fisherman's Marine and Outdoor. We have been an Oregon family-owned business for 36 years. We employ 140 Oregonians at 4 locations. These are stable jobs with benefits, including health and 401k matching. I cannot overemphasize the importance to my family business and to the families that rely on Fisherman's Marine to have open and stable Columbia River fisheries. Our company does very well when these fisheries are open, but when these fisheries close down, we lose 40% of our revenue. To say the Columbia River recreational fishing seasons are unstable is a huge understatement. With safer salmon, we could realize stable sport fishing with up to 8 months of continuous seasons. This would allow our company to expand to 3 or 4 additional local stores. This would employ an additional 120 to 160 Oregonians. As we start replacing the 1,600 jobs lost by 50-year-old Joe's Sports closing. It would also stabilize the over 50 Oregon-owned companies we purchase from. My vision for our state's Columbia River fisheries is these continuous, stable recreational fisheries, resulting in making Oregon one of the top fishing destinations in the U.S. and beyond, as well as stabilizing the guides, charter boats, tackle suppliers, tourism, boat manufacturers, and boat dealers. Also stabilizing Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's funding and the great state of Oregon's tax base. And then I had two other comments. One thing, when Kurt from ODF&W was up here presenting, he presented the catches, and what he was talking about was a main stem, and there was a big difference, and he talked about the sport catching main stem and tributaries. He didn't add the select areas into those catches, which then throws the commercial up. The other is the picture that he showed in there of sport fishing right by Bonneville Dam. There was a whole bunch of sport boats and a whole bunch of sport rods off the bank. That is now closed and hasn't been open for the last couple of years, and I guess that's the exact problem with the stability of fishing seasons.
Great, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. I'm going to invite up the next panel, and we figured out how to reset for 10 minutes. So we'll put that on, and I'm going to ask you guys to divide up so we can have 10-minute panels and time for questions. Bruce Buckmaster, Carrie Johnson, and Jim Wells, please.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I can't help but thinking that when I look at these guys...
Can you speak into the microphone, because I don't think we can hear you.
Well, I just can't help but think when I look at these guys, it makes me think that a bad day fishing is better than a good day at the legislature. Okay,
that may be true. Okay, come on up, gentlemen. What? Okay. Whoever wants to go first, the clock is going to start ticking right now. Okay, so somebody can start talking, and we'll get the slides going. Otherwise, I'll call up the next group.
Chair Dingfelder, Senators, my name is Jim Wells, Astoria, Oregon, lifetime commercial fisherman, Salmon for All president, Columbia River Commercial Advisory Group to the state of Oregon. The first point that needs to be made is that Senate Bill 0736, Safe for Salmon, has absolutely nothing to do with conservation. All fisheries, commercial, sport, and tribal are impact-driven and tightly controlled through the Federal Endangered Species Act. The two main proponents of this bill, which was first introduced in 2009, are NSIA, Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, and the CCA, Coastal Conservation Association. One would have to wonder why a lobbying group with conservation included in their title would promote a non-conservation issue. NSIA is at least up front in their endeavor to reallocate the last of the general public share of Columbia River fish to sole access of the recreational fishery. In a packet that we handed you, I provided you with a net inventory, my personal net inventory, and also a spring fishing schedule for selects. If you would note my net inventory I made, it shows the broad range of gear we employ as commercial fishermen. The nets range from 4.25-inch tangle nets to 9-inch big mesh. Each net is designed by mesh size for a specific purpose. When mesh size is combined with time and area openings, the gill net is recognized as one of the most selective methods of harvest in commercial fishing today. The idea that the gill net fleet deploys one size net that catches everything is a complete misconception of reality. You have been shown charts based on Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and WDF&W catch data that shows an approximate 80 to 20% overall sport commercial catch share for the spring fishery. For 2011 spring, the pre-update model, based on the prediction, shows an 82 to 18% catch favoring the recreational sector. The sport fishery has almost exclusive right to 110,000 fish Willamette River spring run with no tribal take and minimal non-tribal commercial catch. This will lead to hatchery surpluses. Please refer to the top of the page on select area schedules. It's in the packet. That schedule will show that our selects are closing for a full month, March 17th to April 18th, so the Gillnet fleet does not catch even one ESA-listed upriver Chinook. The sport fleet continues to fish in the select areas, even through the commercial closure. This is a no-win-win proposition. The recreational fishery has more than ample opportunity at present to fish in very meaningful and productive fisheries. The taxpaying general public, the consumer, has a right to a share of this Columbia River fish. No biological or conservation justification exists for this bill. Senate Bill 0736 is a very thinly veiled attempt to eliminate the Columbia River commercial fishermen and seriously hurt our lower river communities. Please vote no on Senate Bill 0736. Thank you.
Okay, you guys got 20 minutes between the two of you.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Ed Lackington. I'm the retail manager at the Fisherman's Market in Eugene. The Fisherman's Market is a full-service specialty fish market. We take great pride in having strong direct relationships with quality-conscious fishermen in Oregon and Washington. Through these relationships, we are able to provide access to our customers to some of the state's exceptional resources that they might not otherwise be able to enjoy. Without the production of the Gillnet fleet on the Columbia River, the average citizen in Eugene would not have the opportunity to enjoy some arguably the best salmon in the world, the Columbia River Spring Chinook. We were able to get three of the test fish about a week ago, and we had people waiting at our back door as they're coming in. For them, going to catch those fish themselves is not a feasible option. Without the production from the gillnetters and the fall fishery, we would have to rely on Alaskan caught salmon to get us through the winter months. Our customers prefer local products, and we take great pride in supporting local fishing families. These resources truly belong to all people of Oregon equally, and for many people in Oregon, the gillnetters provide access to these resources. Without them, the average citizen would not be able to access those resources. Thank you for taking the time to consider this important issue. Please vote no on Senate Bill 0736.
Thank you for your testimony. You have to have the lights down so we can see it.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kerry Johnson. I'm a fourth-generation commercial fisherman from Astoria, and my family has been fishing on the Columbia River since the early 1900s, and we are the reason, the salmon fishery is the reason that we settled here in Astoria. Representative Kennemer's comments when we began here struck a chord with me because there was one other person in the room in 1991, and that was my father. He was also involved in the testimony back then and the hearing that was held. The only difference that we have today is we have another generation of fishermen here, and hopefully...
The same legislators.
Yeah.
No. Just kidding.
So, right. So we have another generation of fishermen sitting before you, and well, hopefully not, but I have a young son at home, and maybe one day he'll be sitting in front of you. But anyways, we'd like to be able to continue with our traditional fishing and be able to keep making a living doing what we love to do. But much like America's farmers, commercial fishermen provide a food source for consumers. We take pride in what we do, and we work hard to deliver a high-quality product to your grocery stores, restaurants, fish markets, and ultimately the dinner plate. Columbia River salmon is the finest salmon you can find anywhere in the world, and I consider myself an expert. Senate Bill 736 confines commercial fishermen to certain tiny side channel areas that are simply too small to support the commercial fleet. The bill would immediately end the oldest continuing industry in the Pacific Northwest. These areas were developed by commercial fishermen and provide a good supplement to the mainstem fishery, but they can never take its place. The secret to being a successful fisherman is you have to fish where the fish are, and the mainstem of the Columbia River is where the fish are. My small business will not survive if we are removed from our traditional fishing grounds and into these areas. It would not be economically feasible to continue in the industry that has supported my family and many others for generations, and my son will not have the opportunity to be a fisherman like I have had. Hundreds of jobs connected to our industry would be destroyed, we'd be out of business and into poverty, and with double-digit unemployment, we simply can't afford to lose any more jobs.
It would shift harvest allocation away from the consumer side and give 100% of the Columbia River harvest to the recreation side. The state of Oregon would be in serious jeopardy of losing federal funding that supports its hatcheries, and less than 6% of Oregonians are recreational salmon fishermen, and the rest buy their salmon at retail sources. Federal tax dollars fund hatchery programs, and non-sports fishing, and the non-sport fishing taxpayer deserves to continue to have access to some of these salmon. Oregonians want to purchase sustainably harvested local products, and the Columbia River salmon is the finest food nature can provide. We are hardworking fishermen, earning an honest living, and we want to pass on our way of life to the next generation. We welcome recreational fishermen and the jobs they provide, and there's room on the Columbia River for all of us. We need to work together to increase the abundance of salmon so we can all benefit, the salmon, seafood consumers, tribes, recreational fishermen, and commercial fishermen. Senate Bill 736 is not a win-win. It is one group selfishly demanding that the other group get placed into an area where they simply can't survive. It is unfair, it destroys jobs, and should not be supported. I ask the committee to reject this idea and not move forward with this bill.
Thank you. And you beat the red light. I'm impressed.
I had to go fast.
Any questions for these gentlemen?
I have one. Mm-hmm. Mr. Johnson, the quality of the fish in the safe areas, is it the same quality, better quality, or less quality than that in the main stem?
I would say the quality of fish is not the same quality as the main stem river. There's still a high quality fish, especially in the springtime, but there is a obvious difference in that quality.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. Okay. Next up, we have Dave Schamp. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Bob Reese and Rod Sando. We'll reset our 10 minutes here. This is, as soon as they get started.
So they have a green light, and then when it goes 10, it just turns red.
No, it goes yellow. And then,
Like 1:30.
But there's no countdown.
It just goes yellow. Yeah. I should probably say something. Yeah, and just so you know, the way this works, and our committee members can't see it, it will be green, then it'll start flashing green as you're coming close, and it'll go yellow. It's just like a traffic light. And then red means you're out of time, just so if you haven't used this before.
So the yellow lights are 30-second warnings.
Yeah,
30-second
warning.
Will
your picture be taken when we hit red?
Yes.
Yes, we have photo radar. That's what the cameras are for now.
And that's, just for clarification, that's for the overall 10 minutes,
yes.
Correct?
Thank
you very much.
So you guys can allocate.
Citations are issued by the state officer on the way out.
Thank you very much. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you very much for holding today's hearing and providing the opportunity to voice support for Senate Bill 736. My name is Dave Schamp. I live in Cornelius, and I'm the chairman of the board for the Oregon chapter of the Coastal Conservation Association. Representing 17 coastal states and over 100,000 members, CCA has an unparalleled track record of putting conservation first and successfully battling for sustainable fisheries. Established in 2008, the Washington and Oregon chapters became the fastest growing chapters in CCA's 34-year history. That unprecedented growth was fueled primarily by one issue, harvest reform on the Columbia River. In just 3 years, over 15,000 members have joined, and their number one priority is to eliminate the impacts of non-selective commercial harvest, gill nets and tangle nets, on non-target salmon, steelhead, and sturgeon. The evidence clearly shows that gill nets and tangle nets inflict a high rate of mortality on non-target wild and ESA listed salmon and steelhead, and eliminating those impacts is paramount. In the packet of information that's being provided to you is a graph that shows essentially throughout the entire year there are ESA listed fish in the Columbia River. And as the previous panelists pointed out, Mr. Johnson said that they catch fish where the fish are, and the fish are in the main stem. And that includes ESA and wild fish. As that graph shows, they are there throughout all of those fisheries. The use of gill nets and tangle nets in the main stem Columbia River results in an unacceptably high incidence of bycatch impacts on those non-targeted fish. Recent observer data from this most recent summer Chinook mainstem gillnet fishery showed that for every target Chinook that was harvested, one non-target fish was caught and discarded. We think that's unacceptable. Mr. Melcher mentioned the significant decline in the white sturgeon population. By eliminating the main stem gillnet fisheries, you could reduce the non-target encounters with white sturgeon by as much as 95%. And as Mr. Martin pointed out, there is a viable option. In 2010, the gillnet fishery caught nearly 25,000 spring chinook in the safe areas. An additional 80,000 coho and chinook were taken in those very same areas during the fall fisheries. Those two numbers combined are greater than the entire Columbia River recreational harvest. Also in your packet, we've included a copy of a magazine that includes an article relating to the elimination of gillnetting in the state of Florida. When that took place some 16 years ago, of course, there was the cry that it would devastate the coastal communities, those communities that were reliant on those fisheries. That article explains very clearly that that is not what happened. In fact, the opposite has happened. Those communities are now much more robust than they were 16 years ago. It is time to put the stability and vitality of our declining salmon and steelhead runs at the forefront and take meaningful steps toward their protection. Moving the commercial harvest to off-channel areas keeps their industry viable and supplies the non-fishing public's need for fish. And it takes an important step toward protecting wild and ESA-listed salmon and steelhead. And it's for that reason that CCA Oregon strongly encourages your support of Senate Bill 736.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sando?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rod Sando. I'm recently retired. I serve as a policy advisor for the NSIA, Sport Fishing Association. I came to the Columbia River in a professional capacity. I was the executive director of the Columbia Basin Fish and Wildlife Authority, and that's what brought me to Oregon, and I love it here, and I'm going to stay. Before that, I was a director of fish and game in Idaho, and before that, I was the head of Minnesota Department of Natural Resources for 8 years, and was a veteran of that department for 22 years. And I want to talk to you quickly. I think you have a strategic choice here rather than all this tactical stuff we're gnawing at you about. And I think it's a strategic choice that's based on the long-term economic well-being of the state of Oregon. At times like this, it's a time to be bold and time to take some of this stuff seriously. And I realize the difficulty you have, and you have my sympathies. Nevertheless, I want to tell you that my view is that when you use limited natural resources, as we do, the best strategic policy is to maximize the value added after you first achieve your conservation goals so that you get the most value added out of what you use. And I can give you many, many samples of that. But I want to tell you the main point I want to make for you is that I lived through one of these very issues. It's identical in context in the sense of gillnets being controversial and policy changes that had to happen. In northern Minnesota, on the lake, on the Canadian boundary, there's a very large lake called Lake of the Woods, and I know there's one here, but it's nothing like the big one in Minnesota, and it's half in Canada. And the basin of that lake on the Minnesota side is over 35 miles wide. It's a tremendous walleye factory. It has enormous productivity of walleyes. And in 25 years ago, in the mid-80s, there was a controversy just like this. Sport fishermen were demanding that the changes be made, and there were a small number of commercial fishermen, and it was a viable commercial fishery, but it had this conflict. We had to go to the legislature. They dutifully, after I think three tries, decided that it was time, and that was gillnet fishing was not allowed, and the surplus fish were transferred to the sport fishery. The net effect I want to tell you about is there are three really important things. One was the social conflict got resolved. You didn't have these kinds of hearings anymore. And it made a lot more peace and happiness in the natural resources community. Second was it really enabled the agency to get past that conflict and start to build functioning working relationships with local governments in the north and it really helped that. And the third was the economy boomed. Now, you can't get exactly...
But I want to let you know we have two minutes and 45 seconds left.
That was my last point. Okay. The economy boomed. It created a destination fishery, and now the what was a depressed county is very, very well off.
Okay. Bob, and I'm going to take a little... I'll be right back, but my vice chair will take over.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Bob Reese. I'm president of the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association. We're represented by 30 professional fishing guides and avid anglers, as well as businesses also dependent on healthy sport fisheries. Our mission is to protect, enhance, and promote healthy sport fisheries and the ecosystems they depend on in the Pacific Northwest. Our members represent small rural communities such as Bay City, Welch's, Springfield, Boring, Napa, St. Helens, Sandy, and Rainier, to name a few. We represent Tiny Town, Oregon. This is where we spend our income that we earn from our living as sport fishing guides and charters. We urge you to support Senate Bill 736. I'm going to skip some of my testimony as I see I'm running out of time. What's important to emphasize is how crippled our industry becomes when we are when we have emergency closures placed upon us. Those emergency closures are fairly commonplace on the Lower Columbia now. I have literally turned away customers from Oregon, Washington, California, Utah, and Michigan with airline tickets in hand coming to Oregon to specifically sport fish for salmon in the Columbia River. The very next year, in one case, the very next year, the group from Utah called me up and asked me about where to go fishing in Alaska because of their more stable seasons. A most important point to bring out is that these customers will likely be lost to Oregon's economic engine forever. This year, we're slated to close on April 4th. This is during the peak period of the spring salmon fishery on the Lower Columbia. My membership, meager membership of 34 fishing guides, were able to fish every day after April 4th would provide about $24,000 in revenue just to our community, small community of guides. That's not including motels, restaurants, and tackle stores that they would also be frequenting and helping support the budget of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I urge you again to support the Safer Salmon legislation, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Brzezinski? I have one for you, sir. Considering the fact that you come with a very compelling testimony of $23,800 per day in revenue, does this revenue take into account the lost revenue from the gillnet fisheries?
Well, it is. Although I'm not the economist myself, it is my understanding that that would be made up in the safe area fisheries because of the expanded opportunity that's going to happen with some additional smolt transfers that'll happen in those areas. So again, I don't know if I could effectively answer your question, Senator Olson, as I'm not an economist, but we know that safe area fisheries have produced exponentially larger numbers of production in recent years.
Next, we'll have Rod Moore. Mm-hmm. Rod Moore, Reverend Irene Martin, and Bruce Buckmaster from Salmon for All. And I think to break this up a little bit, we ought to sing Happy Birthday one more time.
You don't want to hear me sing,
Henry. Actually coming at the end of my testimony. So.
Okay, we're ready to go. You're on. Who wants to go first?
I'm first. All right. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rod Moore. I'm Executive Director of the West Coast Seafood Processors Association. We represent primarily family-owned shore-based fish processors and associated businesses in Washington, Oregon, and California. And our members in Oregon certainly purchase gillnet harvested salmon in the Lower Columbia River and select areas, and we'd be affected by this legislation, negatively affected if it's signed into law. In 2010, which is not particularly great salmon year, I've listed here in my testimony. There were over, just our members alone, purchased over 2.4 million pounds of salmon of various species. It's got an ex-vessel value of $4.8 million. There's a standard multiplier that we use in the commercial fisheries of about 2.5 to represent community impacts for the immediate community. So that translates into about $12 million coming into coastal communities in the lower reaches of the Columbia River. And it doesn't count further processing, distribution, restaurants, so forth and so on. There's some additional processing and distribution that takes place in Clackamas for Columbia River fish. So, you know, we're trying to grow Oregon's economy. That's a lot of money to put at risk. People have suggested that we can simply move folks into the select areas, and that'll solve the problem. The economics will work out, so forth and so on. Doesn't work that way. The large part of the fish that are produced in the select areas are coho. Now, I'm a sport fisherman. I love catching coho. They're fun to catch. They're good to eat. But they're not worth as much in the commercial market. So you're already talking about reducing the value of the fishery for both fishermen and processors. There's a timing issue. When you can catch fish in the select areas, it's at a time when those fish are not as valuable in the marketplace. And it just, you know, it doesn't make sense to say, okay, you're going to make up your money by catching fish in this other area at a time when it's worth less. You know, that's not good economics. You know, if you want to create more fisheries in the select areas and put more fish in there, and you want to sort of give those to the gillnet fishermen and say, okay, the sport fishermen can have the river, well, those select area fish are also caught in the river. They're caught in the ocean. So are we going to ban ocean fisheries, both commercial and sport, in order to preserve the select area fisheries? You've heard testimony earlier about how sport fishing occurs in select area, same time as commercial fishing. Are we going to ban both of those? None of that makes sense. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife does a great job of trying to balance out, with foremost emphasis on conservation needs, the needs of the various fisheries in the river. And it just makes no sense in these times to try to put out of business a group of fishermen and the affected processors in communities. That just doesn't make sense at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Martin?
Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Irene Martin. I'm a writer, and I specialize in regional and fisheries history, rather an unusual combination, since I'm also an Episcopal priest at St. James Episcopal Church in Cathlamet, Washington, where gillnetting is a major occupation. I live in Wekiakan County, which has the second highest unemployment rate in Washington. The highest varies from month to month, but somehow we're always second. The commercial fishery is one of the few viable economic engines remaining. In 2005, I wrote a social study, which you have, which gives a lot more detail about what life is like in the gillnet fleet and in the various communities where they are. They are basically an economic magnet for the region, since a number of the fishermen that fish on the Columbia also fish in Alaska and bring that revenue home to Oregon and Washington. I'd like to talk to you, though, about the social problems I'm witnessing, which are measurably worse than I've ever seen. My church operates the local domestic violence shelter for the county. When I checked last week, it's full. Of the last six funerals I've conducted since before Christmas, the dead included one person who had been murdered and three people who had committed suicide. A community workshop was held this past week in Cathlamet to deal with prevention of juvenile suicide in our communities. I'm seeing serious levels of depression, overcrowding as families move in together to try and afford shelter, and lack of access to children to preschool. My church also operates the only preschool in the county, and also the only licensed daycare. And they're being denied access to basic educational opportunities because of the kind of economy we are witnessing due to the Great Recession we're going through right now. This legislation comes at a societal cost that is not discussed in the economic study that supposedly supports it. Indeed, both the study and the legislation don't have the community values or context that I recognize. They leave out the entire state of Washington, despite the fact that many fishermen in our area have Oregon licenses but live in Washington. They ignore the fact that many fishermen do not live in Astoria, where the few limited safe areas are located, but maybe many miles away, so that the main stem is their sole or major access to fish. This legislation will have the effect of transferring virtually the entire sturgeon catch to the recreational fishery, and it also eliminates the incentive for fishermen to work on behalf of salmon recovery. A number of us have been involved in developing salmon recovery plans. I sit on the Lower Columbia Fish Recovery Board, for example. There is no incentive if that fishery is gone. People would be trying to get out of the area and find another way to make a living. Please do not be seduced into the belief that there will be no loss of jobs or community consequences by passing this legislation. The jobs supposedly gained are not interchangeable with the real jobs that are already there. There is no recognition here of vocation, of people who have long-standing family occupational traditions, nor of their role of advocacy for healthy salmon runs, nor of rural community needs or identity. In 2001, the Catholic bishops of the Northwest put together a document. My lovely assistant here, a pastoral letter called The Columbia River Watershed, Caring for Creation and the Common Good. And I worked with the bishops on this one, as did a lot of other people. The key term, I think, in there is commonwealth. Commonwealth implies that we share this watershed in common. Each is entitled to a fair share of its benefits. Commonwealth also implies that we set limits on ourselves and recognize the needs of others. Safe for Salmon does none of these things, but guarantees instead more misery and social havoc to struggling rural communities. And you will forgive me, but it is impossible for me to think of them as low-hanging fruit. Now, that's the sermon. Here comes the fun part.
Okay, and you've got about 2 minutes left on the panel.
The historian in me doesn't want to let the opportunity go by to inform you that 2011 is the 200th birthday of the city of Astoria, a town whose identity is wrapped up in the fishing industry. The best birthday gift for that town. And Senator Olson, I'm sure you're not 200 years old, so you might think about this, however.
Pretty close.
He aged 100 years during this hearing alone, I think.
The best opportunity here would be to reject the Safe for Salmon proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Bruce, you got 1:45
to wrap up. Chair Dingfelder, Senators, thank you. My name is Bruce Buckmaster. I'm from Astoria. I'm a member of the Board of Salmon for All, avid sports fisherman, and community activist. Senate Bill 736 proves that if you have a complex, intensely managed public resource, apply significant misinformation, you can write a bad bill. One, it doesn't aid conservation. Two, it destroys hundreds of jobs. Three, it removes access for the 94% of Oregonians who pay the bill for hatcheries but do not sport fish for salmon. It reduces the overall economic benefit of the resource to Oregon. And it is immoral. Further, it would create a huge loss to sport fishing. Sport fishing is not an efficient tool for harvesting large numbers of hatchery fish. To be successful, large returns are required, and still efficiency only occurs at the peak of the run. Even with increasing runs and active sport and commercial effort, hatchery fish are returning to spawning at rivers in staggering numbers. In 2009, Washington and Oregon hatcheries had 236,000 surplus coho. They had 38,000 surplus fall chinook. They had 15,000 surplus spring chinook. The feds have clearly stated that production will be cut if hatchery fish are not kept from the spawning grounds. Without the commercial tool, harvest tool, the sports will lose opportunity. The facts show this. I know this. And when they worked for all of Oregon, I suspect that some of the authors of this bill knew it as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow, you timed that just perfectly. Okay, any questions for any of the panelists? No? Okay. All right, thank you very much. Okay, we are done with our panels. We're shifting to 2 minutes because we have quite a few people would like to testify, and we are going to be losing some members after 5 o'clock, but the chair and the vice chair will be able to stay. So I'm going to call up in panels of 3, and we're going to just ask you to come up, and you'll have 2 minutes. It's the same thing. It'll be green, then yellow, then red. Steve Fick, Dan Cothran, I'm sorry, I can't read the handwriting, and Kent Martin. Just a reminder, please identify yourself for the record, and if you have testimony, just hand it right off there like that gentleman just did. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Chair Dinkfelder, Senators, my name is Steve Fick. I live in Astoria. I have a seafood processing plant there. We employ about 30 people. I just want to make some real quick points here. If we lose the opportunity to harvest salmon on the river, salmon is about 50% of the income that goes through my plant. That's about half of the production and over half of the economic value of the salmon produced, because the fish that are in the river, a lot of those are economically more valuable than what we're suggesting, as Mr. Moore said, where the cohos are of less value, which there is more volume. I want to make a couple other points here about conservation. We have many nets in this fishery for a reason, because you use a big mesh 9-inch, say, in August when you're targeting salmon and you're targeting healthy wild stocks of Chinook salmon. At the same time, that's when you're letting the steelhead go through. What we do now is what we're doing is a timing of the fisheries now in the spring. We're using tangle net test fisheries, and when the steelhead pass, we will have an opportunity to go and catch salmon. As an example, in 2008, the commercial fishery had a mortality of 9 wild steelhead, while according to the Department of Fish and Wildlife in Washington, it was 1,357 wild steelhead. My other points are that some of these people that are supporting this change are the same people that 4 years ago in Astoria at the Power Planning Council testified in opposition to funding these select areas, and that is on the record of the Northwest Power Planning Council. So with that, I'm short on time. I think it's important that we provide 4 million salmon meals in Oregon through my plant. The fish that Mr. Martin suggested was $44. We paid the fishermen $15. It equates into about $850 in meals in the restaurants and the value for spring salmon. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, whoever would like to go next?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Kent Martin. I'm a commercial fisherman on the Columbia River and in Alaska, and I am the inside net advisor for the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I want to talk a few moments about hatchery reform and the findings of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, which is an independent panel of salmon scientists. Basically, the HSRG found that the large hatchery surpluses returning to the Columbia River are having an adverse effect upon the recovery of our natural spawning stocks. Central to the HSRG recommendations was the development of new technologies that would allow the capture and reduction of large numbers of surplus hatchery fish and the release of many natural spawners. To this end, the gillnet fleets of Oregon and the states of Oregon and Washington have been experimenting with traps, beach seines, purse seines, and tangle nets. It's early yet, but some of the technologies hold considerable promise, with immediate release mortalities being a small fraction of the established hooking mortalities in recreational fisheries, and I'm talking on the order of 1.5 or 2%. The matter had considerable urgency in the National Marine Fisheries with their draft environmental impact statement on the Columbia and on Mitchell Act funding. They basically are proposing cuts in hatchery production of up to 40% throughout the Columbia, including the snake. These reductions would have profound effects on the coastal sport fisheries and commercial fisheries from central Oregon to southeast Alaska. They would also have serious consequences with our catch-sharing agreements and obligations with Canada and the coastal treaty tribes. Any serious consideration of pushing commercial fisheries into select areas needs to be prefaced by an extended conversation with your neighbor state to the north and a likely revisiting of the bilateral treaty with Canada. A mainstem commercial fishery, which is increasingly selective, will not only mitigate this situation, but allow for future increased hatchery and natural production. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, Senators, my name is Dan Cawthon. I'm a county commissioner with Kaikin County. I've heard some pretty good testimony this afternoon. that's totally false for Waukegan County and small counties on the lower river. You talk when there's some discussion about the economic part of it. The economic part of the small counties on the lower river is a commercial fishing industry. These people live and stay in Waukegan County or these other county-specific class of Columbia counties. These are the people that live and work and spend money in Waukegan County. It's not the guide services that come in that brings their food from other places and fish our waters, bring their clients down from other places. Sure, there's some economic benefit to the community, but it's not the economic benefit that the Waukegan County actually needs. What I see from this whole issue is greed. And it's greed from the sports fishermen, and I'm an avid sports fisherman, but I tell you what, I have a hard time saying that I am a sports fisherman from what I've heard today and other testimonies I've done in Olympia. And it's the issue of taking a livelihood from another group to make sure that you get to go out and fish and do all your different things out there, and you talk about money that you're going to do to these communities and what's this going to do for all that. Well, it doesn't for a small community. It lames it. It penalizes it because they don't get the fish. Those are families that I have to look in the face that they don't have a job. It's just, it bumfounds me. But the whole thing is we've got a group, Lower Columbia Fish Coalition, that we have formed. It's Clatsop Pacific, Waukegan, and Columbia County. And what we've found, what has been created, and what you're going to create here today, is an urban-rural conflict. And it's already started. I mean, the sports fishermen from the lower end I'm having a tendency to watch these upriver sports groups fish the Willamette, get two fish limits, and we get to sit there and watch that on TV. We're getting hit too. It's sports and commercial, and it needs to stop. We need to be working together. You want to do something? Let's do something with the Endangered Species Act. That's what's causing most of our problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? No, he already testified. Okay. You were asleep. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I got him.
Madam Chair, I had one question, if I may. How old are you, Senator Olson?
Old enough to know better.
I'm glad I was not the one asking that. So, okay, so Bill Shake, Trey Karskadin, and Karskadin. I always. Karskadin.
Karskadin.
Okay, Trey, I always say your name wrong.
No problem.
Ian Ferguson. Okay, somebody go first. Your time is clicking.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Bill Shake. I'm retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where I was an assistant regional director for fisheries, and I spent several years as a senior policy representative on the Columbia River issues. I'd like to address the purpose and history of selective area fisheries. In a 1995 proposed recovery plan for Snake River salmon, the National Marine Fisheries Services recommended, one, to buy back gillnet permits, two, to mass mark Columbia River hatchery fish, release thousands of these fish in terminal areas such as Young's Bay, where they would be available for commercial harvest. This strategy envisioned that these fisheries would reduce non-selective commercial fisheries in the Columbia River main stem and reduce impacts to ESA-listed stocks. Also estimated that it would be fully implemented by 2002. There's been a tremendous public investment in multiple rounds of buyback of commercial gillnet permits, both in Washington and Oregon, and in the development of terminal area fisheries over the last 20 years. These investments were made primarily using public funding and Bonneville Power Administration funding, not the industry. The permit buybacks were not industry funded like the groundfish buybacks. The purpose was to soften the blow as commercial gillnet fishing was shaped out of the mainstream and into the more terminal areas. It was not designed to make commercial gillnetting more profitable for the remaining fishermen or to supplement full main stem harvest. We need to return to our vision in order to take best advantage of these public investments. I respectfully ask that you consider the conservation needs of these ESA-listed salmon and the economic impacts of fully prosecuted sport fisheries.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Trey, sorry about your name. You should hear what people say about mine, but that's okay.
It's a little froggy from this crud that's been going around the building, so please bear with me. Trey Karskadden, Government Affairs Director for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. I very much appreciate the hearing. Chair Dingfelder's members of the committee. Here to urge your support of Senate Bill 736 on behalf of the sport fishing industry, and I was here in 1991 as well. We've provided you a packet in there. I encourage you to look at our testimony. There's 7 pages of it. It's very detailed. I think it answers the objections. It gives you a lot of substantive information to sift through in making a decision. Here's the bottom line, please. In listening to the opposition today to this bill, it assumes that Senate Bill 736 aim is to put commercial gill nets out of business. That is not the goal of this bill. It is to assure those jobs. So, all of the hyperbole associated with, the skies falling and all the disaster that will come as a result of Senate Bill 736, I ask you to understand that that is not the purpose of this bill. Depending on what numbers you look at, whether there's 292 active permits or 151 active permits, if there's 292 active permits, there's 9,000 fish. You divide that's 30 fish a boat on the average. Or if it's 151, it's roughly 60. Is that really going to be the demise of the commercial fishing industry on the Columbia River? Really? Just to ask you to really think about that. I also am looking forward to continued discussion. That's what I appreciate so much about this forum, is that let's get this behind us. We have been here for 2 decades talking about this and doing nothing. There's an opportunity now, even if we just get our toes wet a little bit, let's show you what we can do. Let's show you the economics that can be generated. Let me give you something very quick here. Take the figure of 200 guides in 4 seats in their boat on an average at $200 a seat. That's $160,000 a day, and that is a conservative estimate, just in the guide community. This fishery generated for the spring fishery 156,000 angler days in 6 weeks last year. It's our testimony. Thank you so much. I urge your support.
Okay, thank you, Trey. We'll try to get this started on time this time. Okay, thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Ian Ferguson. I'm a member of the board of directors of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. And I'm coming today to speak in support of Senate Bill 736. And I do so as a sport angler, but one with a very long history of doing volunteer habitat and monitoring work for wild fish. And there, contrary to what you've heard, there will be a conservation benefit for wild fish. Currently, gill nets and tangle nets have a much higher mortality rate for wild fish than the sport fishery does. And if we remove those nets off the main stem Columbia and into safe areas, many, many fish will make it upstream that would not otherwise make it. And these are wild fish that will be on the spawning grounds. So that is a conservation benefit. And I have to agree with Trey that moving these nets into the safe areas is not going to ruin the lower Columbia commercial fishing industry. It just changes where they fish. They're already catching 2/3 of their catch now in safe areas, and there are going to be many more smolt released to support those safe areas. So the gill netting jobs and the related ones are going to be secure. Oregonians will still be able to buy salmon, Oregon's prized salmon, in fish markets. So those will still be available. And meanwhile, sport fishing seasons will be extended and much more stable than they are now, resulting in a net economic benefit for all the industries, all the jobs, and all the businesses that intersect with sport fishing. And those are huge. There are hundreds of thousands of sport anglers and many, many businesses that intersect with those sport anglers. So I urge you again to please support Senate Bill 736.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel members?
I think I have one.
Okay. Senator Olson.
I've got a lot listed here, and I don't know which one to do best. Mr. Karskadden, if the commercial fishermen are allowed only in the safe areas, could you anticipate or estimate the economic loss to the fleet and how that would affect the economics of Astoria?
I don't believe there'd be any economic loss, Senator. right now, those safe areas, by comparison, in 2009, the safe area catches yielded roughly 97,000 salmon to the commercial fleet, 95,000 to the recreational fleet. And in 2010, that jumped up to 104,000 and 68,000, respectively, to the recreational. We do know that by expanding these fisheries on the sport side, that we believe there'll be significant economic gains. Again, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, members of the committee, the goal of Senate Bill 736 is to assure these jobs. And I think a vigorous discussion going into work group, I think we'll be able to flesh out ideas that will assure that that happens. There can be adequate sideboards. We can, you know, we can assure that those jobs are in place. I don't think there's going to be any net loss in jobs.
One follow-up.
One follow-up.
Once again, for you, Trey, thank you very much for answering these. I'm looking at this chart. You're probably familiar with it.
Yes, generally.
And it says in the mainstream Columbia, the commercial fishermen caught 9,127 salmon. And on the recreational side, you guys caught 34,451. First off, do you not think that losing the sale of 9,000 salmon is not an economic hardship for the gillnet fleet? And secondly, do you think that 9,000 additional salmon only for spring Chinook is adequate to provide enough fishing to make up the loss that the commercial economics loses?
I'll be very quick in my answer, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, thank you. A couple quick points. Again, the perspective on that, 9,000 fish, depending on what number you look at, whether it's 292 active gillnet boats out there, 151, you're looking at respectively an average of 60 or 30 fish per boat. I don't see the demise of the commercial community coming as a result of that. Last year, for instance, they burned up their impacts. It wasn't their fault. It's in the management of this. But burned up their impacts in the main stem Columbia, and we had to forfeit fish in the safe areas that we couldn't harvest. What's going to happen going forward is we're going to be the beneficiaries of increases that have been made in transfers to these safe areas that have yet to hit, plus another $2 million that are expected to come from the Washington side. I see nothing but growth for the commercial gillnet industry. I don't see it going the other way. I think those 9,000 fish will be more than made up in the coming years.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And I'll ask you to possibly follow up with the vice chair on that as well.
Very good. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Hobie Kiter, Tim Hooker, I'm sorry if I'm saying your name wrong, and Mike, I cannot read your last name, but it looks like a Werger. What does that look like to you?
Ooh.
Sorry if I've butchered your name there. Whoever wants to go first, you got 10 minutes.
I'm Hope Kiter. I'm a resident of Astoria, and I am the nonprofit administrator for Salmon for All. I've given you a couple of handouts. First thing that I would direct your attention to is the SAFE program bibliography that actually goes all the way back to the 1970s. I'll direct your attention to one thing, the BPA sponsored study of the evaluation of low-cost salmon production facility by Jim Hill and company in 1988, because Jim Hill, the late Jim Hill, my friend, was the one who came up with a net pen design of his own invention that proved to be tremendously successful. And the Northwest Power Council saw it in the production of the fish in Young's Bay an opportunity to live up to their legal obligations to mitigate for loss of mainstem commercial fishing opportunity. And that is the reason that the BPA provides funding to the select area program. Now I'll direct you to the pie chart. Now this is from the proposal to the BPA for funding in the next cycle. You take a look, the red section, that is the BPA. The yellow section is NOAA Fisheries. The only reason they provide funding to the select areas is to mitigate for lost mainstem fishing opportunity. If our fishermen do not have access to the mainstem, there is no reason to continue that federal funding. And I asked that question directly to the Clatsop Fisheries office yesterday. I said, will they continue funding the SAFE program? No. 66% of the funding disappears. The select area program will not continue if we pass this bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair.
I'm sorry I asked for your name.
My name is Tim Hoyker. I live up in Warrendale, Oregon, which is at the upper deadline of the commercial fishery.
Actually, we only need one microphone because we'll get feedback. Thank you.
Okay. And my family, we represent 9 of the Oregon fishing permits up there, my dad and my brothers and my kids. And none of us fish in the safe areas. We never have. We've always fished up there and in the main stem. And I just wanted to let you guys know that this is no good for us. I mean, we'd pretty much be done. And we clean and process and all our catch ourselves and sell wholesale in Oregon. And this would pretty much be done for us up there. We wouldn't move to Astoria to fish in the safe areas. So we'd pretty much be out of business. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you for coming here.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Mike Wolger. I'm a full-time commercial fisherman in Oregon and Alaska. The Columbia River is an important component of my commercial fishing business. It contributes 25 to 40% of my yearly income. Every year varies. For instance, the 2010 select area spring salmon harvest of 24,000 fish was surprisingly larger than expected, as was the Willamette and upper Columbia-bound fish. In fact, sport fishers kept over 49,000 fish alone in the tributaries of Oregon and Washington. This same select area fishery in 2011 appears to be tracking much like an average or below average year of 4,400 fish, which prior to 2010 is the five-year average. Sport fisheries will continue to take at least up to 40% of salmon destined for select areas. In the summer and fall, select area fish are ran through an intense ocean and buoy tin fishery first. Then we are left to clean up the back end surplus. A lot of times Young's Bay gets too warm. It's shallow water, mud flats. Fish lay out in the main stem of the Columbia where it's deep water and cooler before they come in. The sport fleet sits out there and pounds on them right in front of us until we get a good rain or blow, and then they'll start coming. Our industry voluntarily pays a 10% enhancement tax on the value of fish sold in order to help raise them.
So you've got about 8 seconds left. Okay.
The sport fishery pays net zero. Senate Bill 736 is simply a redistribution of income from a rural part of Oregon, which has the state's highest unemployment rate, given to the recreational industry, who already takes 80% of the salmon resources on the Columbia River. Thank you.
All right, any questions? Okay.
I apologize to those. I have other engagements.
Looks like we're meeting some people here. Okay. Next up, Gary Kish and Paul Meyer and Liz Hamilton. Monday. Then we've got a few folks left after that, and we'll be wrapping up. Okay, whoever wants to go first, we're starting. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Gary Kish, and I've come down from Columbia County today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 736. As Representative Kennemer so reminded us, it was exactly 20 years ago this month that we were in this same place, though I wasn't here, but debating the very same policy issues. This has festered for 20 years. It hasn't gone away. I've given you a pretty detailed handout, so I've listed a couple of high points here. And the first, you'll note at the bottom of the first page, is an analysis by Washington Fish and Wildlife of the value of spring Chinook in both the commercial and sport caught fisheries. They show that spring Chinook in the sport fishery generates over 7 times more direct economic benefit. second page at the top, I've got a little analysis there of the breakdown of our last spring Chinook fishery, and we can see that had those fish been available to the sport fleet, we would have seen about an additional $7 million in economic activity. That's additional economic activity. When it's all said and done, there's no scarcity of salmon on the market, but there is a definite shortage of reliable sport fishing opportunity on the Columbia River. And I hope you'll take a look at what I wrote here about summer Chinook. This is sort of an overlooked fishery that has huge potential, and if this got established, it could definitely help address the poor economies of Wakayakum County. I think we heard eloquent testimony today from the folks that came down from there about exactly how the status quo is not working, and we've got to make these changes. I urge you to resolve this damaging issue. It's not going to go away, and I appreciate you taking this testimony today.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Paul Mayer from Stevens Marine. I live in Sherwood, Oregon. I represent also, as the president of Stevens Marine, the Alumwalt Boat Company, which is our affiliate company. Between those two companies, we employ about 130 people. I'm also here as the president of the Oregon Marine Trade Association, and that association represents several hundred people that rely on this fishery and the success of this fishery to have meaningful seasons and to provide employment. I'm here in support of the Senate Bill 736. Had some things written down, and I'm going to kind of put those aside because I'll just draw from my experience of 30 years in this industry and how the momentum is killed with the entrance of the Gillnet fleet onto the main stem of the Columbia River. There's a lot of excitement and anticipation that builds before that season for a retail customer. That retail customer, early before the season, begins to purchase product and begins to make decisions for those fisheries. Then we have interrupted fisheries that are sketchy as far as when it starts, when it stops. We have controversy with the fisheries because the gillnets go in, and when the gillnets go in, it recreational fisheries cease and seem to stop in their minds, and it kills the momentum for the rest of the fisheries that we rely on so heavily. So I can tell you for sure a compromise like this where the public sees some momentum of a change and paying attention to the issue instead of letting it go for 20 years. And I've been here 30 years in the industry, but they've let it go and you've let it go. And until it finally gets addressed, it's always going to be this pensiveness to make decisions previous to season, and it will always affect the in-season fishing and the momentum, and affect our employees and our ability to earn money to feed our families as well. So I urge you to please support this bill.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelter, Vice Chair Senator Olson, I'm Liz Hamilton, Executive Director of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. And since we're talking about reunions today, I'm going to talk about a different reunion. I was in the office of the National Marine Fisheries Service last week meeting with their director and two of his staff regarding the Michilak hatchery funding and the Michilak DEIS. And in that room, ironically, another white-haired guy was the fellow who handed me that 1995 recovery plan that outlined practically where we are today. That vision handed to me in that plan at that day, the man was there. So we had a great discussion about safer salmon was going to be in the Senate. We had a great discussion about Michilak funding. And the two are not actually interdependent. And in fact, if we do not get our hatcheries reformed and get these fish released in terminal areas, we do risk losing that production because the fish cannot be accessed by the commercials in the main stem because of the huge interactions with wild fish. And I'm going to give you an example of that because we're practically dancing on a pin when we try to figure this out. If you look at the data right now on ODF&W's website, the test fishing so far this year has caught 72 fish in the main stem test fishery. Of that 72 fish, only 40 of them have been bycatch. 72 fish caught, and 40 of them have been bycatch that had to be thrown back. That doesn't count sturgeon. That's just steelhead and wild salmon. So it's very, very tough, no matter what size net you do, to have a fishery out in the main stem that is of a large enough size to scoop up hatchery fish. Now, since those big returns we discussed where the commercials are now getting more than the sports in the safe area, the states of Oregon and Washington have transferred 40% more hatchery fish into the safe areas. So when you look out, when we look out into 2012 and 2013 and beyond, we have a 40% increase of smolts that were put into the river. And Washington's looking for another 2.5 million. They're looking to build their sites to put another 2.5 million in the safe areas. So is moving 9,000 fish in the spring Chinook fishery, for instance, which is 72,000 angler trips, I'll cede my time. I understand there are other people who wish to speak, and I'm ready to answer any questions you might have.
Do you have any questions?
I do, for Mr. Meyer.
Yes.
Thank you for coming and testifying, and I would ask you one question. Would you be concerned if this body, legislative body, would write a bill to limit your marketing area?
I don't think this bill is about limiting the market area. I think it's about helping compromise and creating a win-win situation that will allow everybody to go forward together and create a better situation.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have a few more folks left up to testify. Darren Cruikshank, Brian. And Larry Olson. Larry here, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dinkfelder. My name is Darren Cruikshanks. I'm the president of the Columbia River Fishermen's Protective Union. We've been in existence since 1884. It's 127 years. We negotiated the fish ladder at Bonneville. That's just one of our things. We've been around a long time. We continue to plan on that. I'm against the Senate Bill 0736 for these reasons. The safe areas are too small to handle our whole fleet. I live in Longview. I don't go down there. It is impossible to stick 250 boats in the area that you saw on the screen there. It doesn't give us a fair and equitable share of the main stem Columbia River fish that we should have access to. There's no guarantees on the funding in the safe areas. You've heard about hatchery reform. If we don't get these surplus salmon off the hatchery, surplus hatchery fish off the spawning grounds, they're going to cut production. Loss of fish tax revenue from Washington and Oregon. You're going to give up thousands, if not millions, maybe more, in tax revenue in both states. And I don't think Washington's going to go along with that. Loss of jobs in Washington and Oregon. This bill simply denies the access to the public, which owns this resource, the 94%. I got an idea of how we could make some new revenue for the state of Oregon, turning the Multnomah Channel and the Willamette River into another safe area. Let's expand it. Let's work on those hatchery fish. And I'm also on a alternative gear study group for Washington. We've been doing purse seining, beach seining, traps, and everything else, and been showing some great promise. We've done everything humanly possible to study new ways and how to limit our mortality on such species. So with that said, I thank you for your time, and please think about this.
Thank you for your testimony.
Senator Dinkfelder, Chair, my name is Brian Terbakia, fourth-generation fisherman. Wrote a testimony here, but I think what I ask the most of you is to be able to look through cherry-picked numbers and mortality rates. And this is a lot to comprehend for a group of five people to learn fisheries politics and everything that goes along with it. Sea lion mortalities issued with sea lion mortalities rates are issued with our gear on a 2% rate. So that's where 14.5 comes up with. Sport mortalities are at 10 with no sea lion mortality associated to it. You can ask any of the sport fishermen. It's a common problem. I'm very active in test fishing. You heard Liz Hamilton testify about our steelhead handle. That's why we test fish. We've had the steelhead handle, and if you can look at our past handle on steelhead for our past 3 years in our spring fishery, we got it down to less than 0.5%. That's why we do that. To understand it, I understand, is hard. There's nothing more I'd rather do than sit here and I can get upset that someone's attacking me and attacking my job. I want to take the high road. I want to do the right thing for the resource. We owe it to the resource. I'm fourth generation. I didn't get to the fourth generation by the first generation catching all the resource. That's why we're here. We want to protect it. The sea lions are decimating, and there's nothing more I'd rather do, be here with your Senator Olson with the birthday card saying that the sport and Lower River Commercial and tribes are working together on the pinniped problem and the bird predation. If you look at the big picture, you got to get together. You got to take the boxing gloves off and join pool resources, not split resources. I would rather be home right now doing something constructive, not here talking about dead-end avenues.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, I'm Larry Olson. I'm a commercial fisherman from Astoria. Been fishing for 50 years. I started when I was 13. So you can do the arithmetic and figure out how old I am. Where am I going to go if this bill passed? What am I going to do? Also, I'm a veteran of Vietnam. I fought for this country, and now there's people that want to put me out of work. I spent 4 months in a hospital in California from wounds in Vietnam. I came home. The only thing, I started when I was 13. The only thing left, okay, fishing is still there. I'm still fishing today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Sir, I thank you for your service.
And thank you for your service. Thank you for being here today. We have two people left, Bryce Devine and Nathan. Nathan, I can't read your last name. You guys don't get extra marks for penmanship today.
Hey, Madam Chair and Vice Chair, thanks for the opportunity to speak. There was one item that didn't get touched on in this idea of moving.
Oh, could you state your name for the record?
My name is Bryce Devine.
Thank you.
I'm a commercial fisherman. When you fish in Young's Bay, I fished in there extensively. On a typical opening, you'll have 30 boats between the bridge. The bridge is there in Young's Bay. And when the time comes to lay out, everybody lays out. And when you get done laying out, you're lucky to have the distance, the width of this room between your nets and the other ones. If you move more boats into there, no matter how many fish you plant, it's not going to catch, it's not going to distribute. There's going to be some people, a few people that camp out at the lower deadline and the upper deadline are going to do real well. The rest of us aren't going to get anything. It just will not work out. The mechanics of this are different. We're not just a number. You know, these guys throw around a number of fish. Oh, we can put this number here and this number there. Well, you know, you can put them in a dump truck and dump them on the street and we can fight over them. And that's not equitable just because the numbers are there. You have to consider the whole picture. And also, there's been quite a bit of testimony on economics of this issue. And the curious thing about this economic problem is that they're trying to attach a value to a fish. If they want to increase the economic value of the sport fishery, that could be accomplished by cutting the bag limit in half. The money that they spend to go on a trip fishing would be the same. Their take would be less. They would have a lower impact. And that's why they're comparing apples to oranges here. And the economic story doesn't add up just from that fact. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and Senators, thank you. Glad for the chance to talk. Worked long and hard. Proud to be part of the commercial industry here.
Can you say your name, please?
Nathan Rogel. And commercial fisherman, proud to be part of the industry. We are the role of harvester of the fish, of the general public's resource, is one that we're proud of and we love, and it's a heritage in the history of the whole region and the lower Columbia mostly. Some of the details of this whole issue are undisputable facts, and one is that it's the resource of everyone. It's funded almost entirely by federal funds. It's not fishing licenses and tags. It's federal, and it is truly everyone's resource. Equity and allocation is part of the statutes. There's nothing equitable about giving all of the main stem resource to one user group and shrinking the traditional areas by 99%+ for commercial fishing. Senate Bill 736 is unreasonable, would devastate the commercial fishing industry and most Columbia River communities. The idea that the industry can survive in sect areas only is ridiculous. Last year's good catch was an anomaly. The average is much lower. The current situation this year is a case in point. The early one-day-a-week seasons in the main stem caught somewhere around 70 salmon and nearly the same number of sturgeon. And so far in the select areas, there have been about 90 salmon caught. Many fishers have not even caught one fish yet, and we desperately need our allocation, which we may get this week or next. But we need the chance to go fishing in the main stem, and we should have the right to do it. I don't understand how people can support this Senate Bill 736 without feeling selfish and even being embarrassed. There's a irrational hatred for the commercial fishing community by some people, and they seem to say just about anything that they think will get that point across. Another one issue is that there would be this great economic boom if in sales of boats and tourism, if the resource was given to the sport fishing. But people who are passionate about fishing are buying boats. They have opportunity all over the place, many species, many areas, year-round fishing, rivers and lakes everywhere.
Sir, can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Okay. The very end. On the front of the building here, written in stone, as we walked in, I noticed this, and I thought it was good. This inscription is, "A free state is formed and maintained by the voluntary union of the whole people, joined together under the same body of laws for the common welfare and sharing of the benefits justly apportioned." And Senate Bill 736 does not do that. So please kill it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. That's all the sign-up we have. Anybody else that would like to testify who didn't get a chance to sign up? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 736, and we'll close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Thank you.